Sorry, would people, I assume those of you who are interested know that the answers are up on the webpage. Do you have questions about those answers, or would you rather just go through the whole thing?
Can we ask them next time if we...
Sure.
I didn't know they were up there yet.
I understand. Sure. No, you know, that had not occurred to me, but it's a perfectly reasonable alternative. Fine. So you can look at your midterm, you can look at the webbed answers, and if it doesn't make sense, then that'll take care of it. All right. Oops, sorry. So in that case, I can just start going and talk about finance. Basically, three of the topics that this book covers are really economics, even though only one of them is straightly labeled that. And this is the first of them, mostly economics. And finance is basically the analysis of the decision problems which involve allocations over time in a world of uncertainty, which is the world we live in, for good or ill. And it's mostly in the context of firms, investors, and such. So that one of the questions we're going to want to think about at the beginning is, why do firms exist? What's their function? What are the problems in the firm? And how do those problems affect choices such as, do you sell stock or borrow money? How do you reward your executives? Should stock ownership be concentrated? A whole bunch of those questions. And we start out with the other famous Coase article. Actually, maybe there are three famous Coase articles, actually, but if you were doing my law and econ course, we would have talked a whole lot about Ronald Coase, because a different article of his is probably the most famous article in that literature. But the other one is The Nature of the Firm, and that starts with a puzzle that I like to describe as the puzzle of why the capitalist beach is made up of socialist grains of sand. That if you think of two different ways of coordinating human activity, the non-obvious one that works brilliantly well is the decentralized mechanism of I own stuff, you own stuff, we trade if we have a net gain to it. The obvious one, which on the large scale seems to work very badly, is there's a boss and he tells everybody what to do. All right, so if you look at places like the Soviet Union, they were not very happy or prosperous places, and they tried to organize the whole thing on that basis, at least in theory. But then if you look at a society like ours, you say, wait a minute, it's true that there are lots and lots of market interactions done on the decentralized system, but then you look at General Motors, at Microsoft, even at much smaller firms, and what do they look like? They look like small versions of a centrally planned economy, right? There's the president of the company, and he's giving orders to people down the line, and they're giving orders to people down the line, and he's figuring out what everybody should do, and you do this, and you do that, and so forth. So then the question is, why is that the case? Why don't we have what to some of us sort of who are very pro the market seems like the obvious solution, which is run the market all the way down, that everybody is an independent contractor. If I want to hire a secretary, I, you know, pay her to type up my manuscript. And if I need an office, well, I need an office for today, so I rent an office for today, and so on. You could imagine a system like that. And in fact, something like that did exist for some industries in the 19th century. It was what's referred to now as the inside contracting system, in which the example I remember reading about is the making of guns, of rifles, and you have a single building, and space in that building is rented by several different firms, and one of the firms makes the stock for the gun, the wooden part, and one of them makes the barrels, and one of them makes the receivers, the sort of part where the bullet goes in and where the trigger is attached to and such, and then another one buys the parts from the other three, assembles them, and sells the guns. And in some ways, that's a pretty attractive model. It means that each of those is a smaller firm than if you had a single firm doing all of it. It's easier for the guy who owns the firm to know what everybody's doing and make sure it's done right. But there are some problems. And one way of seeing the problem is to ask what happens to firm B, C, and D if firm A gets shut down because the owner is sick. That they stop, basically, because they don't have the stock that they need for making the guns, or else they keep making the other parts and they accumulate, and maybe, hopefully, they can eventually do something about it. And so over time, the inside contracting system tended to get replaced by a larger firm coordinating all of the pieces. And if you think about our economy, there are parts of ours which really are markets pretty nearly all the way down. If you think about a freelance writer, let's say, or a kid who mows lawns, the people who mow our lawn. I suppose there are a bunch of them. I don't know if they're a firm or a family or what. I never went into the details, but it's a handful of people working together, and we pay them for mowing our lawn. And that system works very well, where what you're buying is a fairly well-defined good or service at an instance. So, you know, there's no need for a long-term contract with the restaurants that I go to, with the hotels, with any of those things, or with the grocery store. On the other hand, if people are coordinating their activity over time, something we've discussed in the context of contracts, now life gets more complicated. And we've seen both how you try to do that by contract, but also the kinds of problems that it raises. That in a certain sense, the bottom line of our chapter on contracts is whatever you do, something is going to go wrong, or something can go wrong. And what you're trying to do is to set up the contract that minimizes the problems, figure out what's going to go wrong with that form of contract, and then do what you can to control that. And so that suggests an alternative way of structuring these relations over time, and that's pulling them inside the firm. So the basic firm contract is much more complicated, but the simple firm is that you do what the boss tells you within certain limits. You're not obligated to assassinate someone if he tells you to do that, and maybe it's only 9 to 5 or 9 to 5 with extra for overtime or something. And if you don't like what he tells you to do, you can always quit. But within it, what he's really buying is not you're doing X or you're doing Y, but you're doing what he tells you when you tell him to. That, however, also raises problems. All right, that's sort of one of my books, my Law and Econ book. I've got one issue where I run through, why don't we do X? It'll raise this problem. We solve this problem the following way, but that solution raises. We solve that problem. I go through about 6 rounds of this, and I find it's often a useful way of thinking your way through complicated situations. So in this case, the firm has a problem, and the firm's problem is that instead of the costs of using contracts to transact in the market, you've got the cost, if you're the boss, of monitoring your employees, of somehow making sure that people who really don't care very much whether your company makes money, but do care whether they get along with their friends, don't work too hard, get paid well, things like that, somehow you've got to set things up so that you make it in their interest to do the things that you want them to do for the firm's success. And if you think about it, the more layers of control you have, the harder that's going to do. So that gets us back to the advantage of the inside contracting system, which is all the firms have to know about each other is, are you delivering barrels that work, not, you know, who came to work on time and so forth. So that gives us some idea. So Coase's original model is think of a firm as drawing its lines just at the point where it becomes, where it switches from being cheaper to solve problems by the employer-employee model to the point at which it is cheaper to solve problems by simply dealing with somebody outside the firm. And that's an issue that's become important with outsourcing, where you're moving things out of the firm instead of inside of the firm. It's an issue which is important when people talk about either making firms bigger by merging or making them smaller by spinning off things. And all of this really Coase gives us a useful framework to think about why the optimal firm is neither a single firm the size of the world nor a single person just selling his own services. Now, another problem this then raises is a problem which the textbook incorrectly attributes to Burrell and Means. Burrell and Means wrote a famous book raising this problem, but when the textbook tells you, isn't it significant that this book was written in 1932 during the Great Depression and that nobody noticed the problem before that, they are demonstrating the ignorance of whoever wrote that chapter, because the problem that Burrell and Means wrote their book about was described in detail by Adam Smith in 1776. And his model was not General Motors, but the British East India Company, which was a joint stock company that kept going bankrupt in spite of having the wealth of India to loot. So the basic problem, which is associated with Burrell and Means, because they're the people who brought it to our attention in the 20th century, is that you have a firm that needs a lot of capital, and it therefore organizes a joint stock company, what we think of as the standard stockholder-owned corporation. And it's clearly an unworkable system because each stockholder owns only a tiny fraction of the firm. So therefore, from the standpoint of one stockholder, it's not worth his spending a lot of time and effort watching what management is doing to making sure they're maximizing the value of his stock, because if he does that, he's going to get, you know, 1/1,000,000th of the benefit of his efforts. Consequently, management can do what it likes with the stockholders' money, and therefore the whole system can't possibly work, and it's just a figment of our imagination to believe that a large part of the economy is run this way. And Adam Smith did not, in fact, see any good solution to this problem. Smith's conclusion was that the only place you would get joint stock companies was in industries which had two characteristics. First, they needed a lot of capital, more than any single entrepreneur could provide or raise. And second, what they were doing was so easy, so simple, that without a whole lot of trouble, people could observe and tell if they were doing a good job. And the British East India Company did not meet those requirements and ran very badly, and he thought that without accepting that case, the simpler model of a basically proprietor-owned firm would always outcompete the joint stock company. He was wrong. We now know he was wrong. Why was he wrong? And part of the reason he was wrong is that he had not thought about the takeover bid. Because the takeover bid provides, in principle, a solution to the Burl and Means problem, which neither Smith nor, I think, Burl and Means, though I haven't read their book, I have read Smith, considers. And that is that if we have a corporation where the management is doing what it pleases with the stockholders' money, the result is that the value of the stock will be low, because the corporation won't be making very much money relative to what it could make if the management was doing its best to maximize profits. Well, if the value of the stock is low, that means that it's tempting for somebody who's in a position to raise a lot of money to buy up a whole lot of the stock, enough so that he can replace management. And that doesn't require a majority, because a lot of the stockholders are never going to vote, given the dispersed ownership, but he has to acquire quite a sizable chunk of stock, and he can then take over the company, throw out the managers, put in some people who he has selected and is going to watch and is going to fire if they don't do a good job, and those people will then run the firm well, and in a couple of years it'll be obvious to the rest of the world that the firm's doing much better than before, and so his $50 million worth of stock will now be worth $500 million, at which point he sells his stock and goes looking for another badly run corporation. And that's the sort of model of how a takeover bid provides one possible imperfect mechanism for disciplining corporations. And as some of you may know, our current legal system has a variety of provisions designed to keep this from happening. Provisions, naturally enough, supported by incumbent management of corporations at both the state and federal level, in particular provisions in which if I'm trying to accumulate stock to take over a company, when I get to a certain fraction of ownership, I've got to say so, I've got to make it public, which of course means that if I'm any good at takeovers, the rest of the market will say, aha, he's trying to take it over, let's not sell our stock except at a high price because he's going to take it over and stock will go up, let's us make the money instead of him. So that makes it more difficult for this mechanism to work. Other mechanisms that try to control it are basically ways of trying to tweak the incentives of the managers so that the managers will make more money if the company makes more money, such as bonuses, options, and so forth. It's not clear that any of them are very well designed. There's been a lot of complaint about bonuses lately because of companies that are going bankrupt and paying large bonuses. And options, if you work it through, give a rather skewed set of incentives to the person who holds them, because if the stock goes down below his strike price, below the price his options are set at, he doesn't lose any more money, whereas if it goes up, he gains money, and therefore he has an incentive to take gambles in which he's risking a loss that he's not going to pay for in exchange for a gain that he is. I should say that's a general issue you want to think about in lots of different contexts. The situation, I think the description somebody had of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac some years before the current crisis was that what they had done was to privatize profits and socialize losses. And that's in fact how it worked out, and you can see that that gives a skewed set of incentives to the people who are running the firm. And it's at least been argued that if you look at the difference between hedge funds and mutual funds, that the hedge funds have a better come closer to giving the right incentives to managers because the hedge fund managers get a percentage of the increase in the value of the fund, whereas the mutual fund managers get a fixed percentage of the amount of funds that they manage. and there's supposed to be, this is not my field, so I don't know how good the evidence is, some evidence that hedge funds are more successful at managing money to make money for people. Further, so the first problem is how do the stockholders manage to discipline the managers, essentially? And takeover bid is one way. Another possible way is to try to structure the incentives of the managers, but that, as I say, is fairly hard. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Another potential problem is conflicts among stockholders, that if I've got a block of 20% of the stockholders and we're the only people who bother to come to the meeting because we know there are enough of us so we can actually affect things, we might get the corporation to do things that are in our interest but not the interest of the rest of the stockholders. So that, for example, that 20% might be held by another corporation. If they do business with each other, there's the possibility for us to vote to have the corporation we own stock in buy the products of the corporation that we own all of at a very favorable terms, thus, in effect, transferring a dollar to us at a cost of 20 cents to us and 80 cents to the other stockholders. Similarly, you could think of other potential things. The majority stockholders might vote to take the firm private on terms that benefit them. And there are various legal mechanisms that attempt, with how much success, I'm not sure, to limit the ability of people to do this. That basically, there are rules which say, in effect, you aren't supposed to have self-dealing. You're supposed to offer the other stockholders the same terms. If you take the limiting case, you could imagine a majority of the stockholders just say, all right, we're going to dissolve the firm, turn it all into money, hand it over to the majority stockholders, give none to the minority stockholders. That clearly is illegal. And where between that and matters of judgment that happen to be all biased to benefit the majority stockholders, where the law can draw its line is obviously a hard problem. Let's think a little bit about legal issues to which this academic literature on what the function of firms are, why they don't work, how you deal with their not working, and so forth is relevant. And clearly, there are, I think, at least three different sets of legal issues. And the first is one which comes up especially in the antitrust context, and that's the size of the firm. So that we observe two firms that want to merge, and one of the questions that the antitrust division wants to ask is the reason they are merging because the combined firm can really produce better products cheaper, in which case we should probably let them do it? Or is the reason they want to merge because the combined firm will now be a monopoly or close to a monopoly, and it can cut output, jack up prices, and make lots of money? So part of answering that question is to say, well, what are the reasons why big firms have advantages? And if it turns out that they are joining two parts of the same productive process in a way which reduces some of the costs of dealing by contract outside the firm, then it's more plausible than if you're just taking two firms, both of them are doing the same thing, they have no particular advantage to being bigger, but they're putting them together. One of my friends, I think at UC Irvine, maybe not, anyway, some economist I knew, had a great scheme for how the antitrust division should decide whether to approve mergers. And the idea was that when a merger is proposed, you ask the other firms in the industry what they think of it. You don't really have to ask them. They're going to tell you anyway. And if the other firms in the industry are in favor of the merger, you don't allow it. And if the other firms in the industry are against the merger, you allow it. Is it clear why this is a sensible rule, at least until the other firms catch on? If we're merging to monopoly, if there are other firms, it can't be a literal monopoly, but we're going to end up with 90% of the industry. And why do we want to do that? Not because a big firm is any more efficient, right? This is the case where the reason we want to do it is we say, all right, we'll now cut output, prices will go up, take a fair while before new firms come into the industry, and meanwhile we'll be making out like bandits. Suppose you're one of the 10%. What's your reaction to that strategy? Yep?
Well, I think you'd be happy about it because you can raise your prices.
That's right. It's wonderful. You don't have to restrict output, right? So you'll do even better than the monopolist out of it. Great. On the other hand, suppose what's going on is really that these two firms have complementary productive abilities, and you put them together and bang, they're going to be able to make money at a lower price than they ever could make money before. Now the competitors aren't going to like that at all. So his argument, at least, was that the competitors would oppose good mergers and support bad mergers, and as long as the competitors didn't realize that was what the antitrust division was doing, you could use them to decide who. I thought it was a very clever idea. But, like many clever ideas, it probably wouldn't work, but it's still a clever idea. So, as I say, so the one issue is antitrust law. A different issue is from the standpoint of the stockholders, that the stockholders, in deciding whether or not they should approve of the merger, which they may have to vote on, may want to say, wait a minute, is what's really going on that there are complementary abilities in these two firms, or what's going on is that the head of one of the firms wants to be a more important person, he wants to be the head of the American National Association of Manufacturers, and they only, let us suppose, allow firms that have at least a $50 billion asset, capital market cap or something like that. He wants to have more people who under his authority. He's a guy who, you know, he made money a long time ago, and he wants now his sort of power and status and importance. That's empire building. And that's, again, theories of why firms are or should be the size they are become relevant. And, of course, even aside from those issues, if you're the CEO, you want to read Coase. Because if you're the CEO, you say, well, look, we've been buying from this smaller firm that produces one of our inputs for 5 years. Maybe we should buy them out. Maybe we'd be better off running them. Maybe we wouldn't. How do we decide? And that's the kind of question that Coase's way of thinking about firms will help you answer. Similar, of course, in the other direction, if a firm wants to spin off things, that, you know, you see people who say, well, look, isn't it terrible? They're just selling off their assets. Obviously, you know, something's wrong. But, of course, it's not obvious that something is wrong. The alternative is, no, the CEO before had something wrong. He was an empire builder, and he acquired 17 firms. There was no reason why they ought to be part of his firm, and he ran them into the ground. And now if we just sell them off to somebody who will do a decent job of running them, they'll offer a higher price than they're worth to us, and we can make ourselves a tougher, leaner firm when we limit to doing the one job we're good at and sell off the other things that we're not good at. So, again, these are really the same issues. So, as the size of the firm is one thing where the sort of economics finance theory about why you have firms and what determines their optimal size becomes relevant. Second issue, going to Burl, Means, and Smith, is the issue of managerial discretion. How much discretion should managers have? Pretty clearly, if the manager votes one day that the entire cash assets of the firm will be handed over to him as a special retirement benefit after which he will retire, there are going to be legitimate legal complaints against that exercise of discretion. On the other hand, the reason you have a firm is the idea that having somebody in charge telling people what to do has some real advantages over coordinating everything by individual contracts, so therefore you don't want to have a situation where every decision the manager makes anybody else can second guess and go to the court and say he shouldn't do this, this doesn't serve the stockholders, make him do that instead. That ends up with the firm being run by the courts, which are almost certainly less competent to run it than the CEO is. On the other hand, back to Burl and Means, the more discretion the manager has, the greater the opportunities he has to benefit himself in one way or another at the cost of the stockholders. Now, benefiting himself isn't limited to money. Benefiting himself might mean being lazy. It might mean promoting his friends or people who flatter him or people who get along well with him over more competent people. Maybe not promoting somebody who's too competent because that person might end up getting his job eventually. You can think of a lot of different ways. One example, and this is sort of an argument people have made from time to time, has to do with the idea of, quote, socially responsible firms. That the usual sort of public attitude is the fact that this firm gives large donations to the opera shows they're good people. They're public-minded people who care about the welfare of our city. And similarly for helping out the local schools and many other things. And the flip side of that is say, wait a minute, what you mean is the CEO is being generous with the stockholders' money. The stockholders want to give money to the opera, they can do it easily enough. But what does the CEO get by giving money to the opera? Well, he probably gets a really nice seat at the opera. He gets invited to high society events. Note that subsidizing the opera is a subsidy to the upper classes, not to the lower classes on average. I'm sure there are a few poor people in the audience, but most of them do not dress as though they're having trouble figuring out where the next meal is coming from. And so you can at least argue that if the CEO is doing anything other than maximizing the profits of the company, he is in fact derelict in his duties. He is an unfaithful servant, as it were, who is buying what he wants in terms of status, perhaps, or even feeling good about doing good in the world at someone else's expense. Now, it's tricky, of course, because he might argue, and it might even be true, that these things actually benefit the firm. That, after all, the mayor is one of the opera fans, and if we want to not have too much trouble with zoning restrictions when we build our new factory, it would be nice if the mayor feels as though he owes us a favor. You might say, well, the reason we're helping out the local firms isn't that we're nice guys. The reason is that we hire a lot of employees from those firms. And not only does helping them out mean they'll be training people better, it means that there will be people in the school who feel an obligation to us and will tell us which of their students are really smart and which ones we ought to stay away from. So if you think about, I have no firsthand experience at all with law school fundraising, but I presume that part of what's going on is law firms buying information. That is, I assume that one of the things that's going on is that a Silicon Valley law firm that gives lots of money to Santa Clara assumes that when they ask Don Polden, does he have any really good students this year, he'll tell them the truth. And my guess is that he might be less willing to volunteer information about that to a law firm that hadn't given us money. That's conjecture. I don't have any data on the subject. But it's the way I would be running things if I were doing it. So I think it's Don appears to be a competent guy, so I suspect it's how he does it, too. So it's not trivial to figure out. That is, I think what's trivial is to say that a manager being generous with the firm's money is not a morally virtuous act. It's not necessarily a morally unvirtuous act either, but it's not his money. That it either, I suppose you could say it's a Robin Hood virtuous act, if you say he's stealing from the stockholders to benefit the schools. But mostly, we don't usually think, except in movies, we don't usually think of that as being a good guy.
He's still evil. Robin Hood is still a disgusting character. Batman would get him.
Different people agree. Yeah, disagree about that, but right. Yeah. And it might be that he's really serving his stockholders just in non-obvious ways. That's certainly possible. It might be that he is serving himself at the expense of the stockholders. Have any of you read any books by C. Northcott Parkinson? I highly recommend. And he was an English academic who wrote a series of collections of essays which are making serious points in humorous form. He's best known for Parkinson's Law. Parkinson's Law is that the number of people employed by a bureaucracy increases at a constant rate, independent of whether the work to be done increases, decreases, or whether there's any work at all. And this sounds sort of like a joke. I should say there's another statement. The individual version of Parkinson's Law is work expands to fill the time available, which many of us have experienced. But it sort of sounds like a joke. But then after he makes this gives lots of sort of imaginative examples, Parkinson then gives us some data. And the data he gives is on the bureaucracy in London that ran the British Empire during the time when the British Empire was vanishing. All right, in 1900, the map is colored red. Huge chunks of the globe are under the rule of the British. By the end of World War, a little after the end of World War II, when India gets independent, there's nothing left. There's just England and, I guess, Ireland, and part of Ireland, Northern Ireland, and Scotland and Wales, and that's it. And yet the number of people employed by that, I think it's called the Colonial Office, keeps climbing right through that period. And he has a second graph which shows the onshore staff of the British Admiralty, the clerks responsible for the British Navy. Well, at the end of World War I, England had the largest navy in the world. indeed, I remember a discussion of some of the treaty negotiations after that, when the British were generously willing to agree to a disarmament treaty that would abolish all warships bigger than cruisers. And as the historian pointed out, this was at a time when the British not only had more cruisers than anybody else in the world, but more cruisers than everybody else in the world put together. Get from there to the point when the British barely managed to scrape out a victory over Argentina up in the Malvinas, and what happens to the number of clerks in the Admiralty, it's rising right through that time. Anyway, Parkinson is a lot of fun, and he's making serious points, but in humorous and memorable fashions, and one of them is an anecdote on just this question where he's describing a firm, and there are two different executives, and some guy has come trying to raise funds for what he claims is a good purpose, and one of the executives said, you know, I sympathize with him entirely. I try to persuade our board of directors to make a generous donation. What did you do? He said, I gave him $20 and told him to go to hell. And obviously, Parkinson thinks the second one is the good guy. So as I say, all of these issues are relevant to the size of the firm, but they're also relevant to the whole issue of managerial discretion. To what extent can other players second-guess the managers and limit what they can do? And then the final one, suggested by what I said a few minutes ago, is the limits to majority stockholder control. To what extent can the majority stockholders vote to do whatever they like with the company, and to what extent can the minority go to the court to stop certain things which they regard as exploiting them for the benefit of the majority? Any questions on this stuff? Please do jump in and stop me if necessary. I realize it's hard, but it's not impossible. All right, let me now go on to the next bit of this, where we're going to talk a little bit about the Miller-Modigliani theory. But I want to say a little bit about the general issue of the use of simplifying assumptions. Because if any of you are going to be academics, the use and misuse of simplifying assumptions is an important issue in both writing and reading academic work. By the misuse, I mean getting some striking result which only exists because you're simplifying assumptions and not because of the system you're looking at. Where simplifying assumptions are useful is if you want to figure out the basic logic of some system and you want to get away from the undergrowth for the first pass of thinking it through, as it were. So Coase famously, in his really famous article, analyzed issues of externalities, of cases where my action imposes costs on you, in a world where there were no transaction costs, where any time there was a deal between us that would produce a benefit for the two of us, we would find some way of making that deal. And what he demonstrated was that in that world, externalities could never be a problem. Because any time that I am polluting your air and the cost of the pollution control to me is less than the benefit to you of getting clean air, if I've got the right to pollute your air, you'll make an offer to me which I'll accept for me to stop doing it. If I don't have the right to pollute the air, but if pollution control is really expensive, I'll make an offer to you to buy the right to pollute your air for money in exchange for my not having to spend a fortune on scrubbers or whatever. That's what's called the Coase theorem. It's a small part of a much longer analysis. And if you're sufficiently curious, there on my webpage, there's an article of mine called The World According to Coase. I don't guarantee that Coase agrees with it, because Coase's comment on that article was that you never really understand your ideas until someone else explains them to you. And given Ronald Coase, to this day, I do not know whether that was intended as a sarcastic comment or not. But in any case, I think gives a coherent explanation of the ideas, which are sort of at the core of modern law and econ. But that's relevant only as one example of the use of a simplifying assumption, not to say that we're in a world of zero transaction costs, but of saying that one way of looking at all of these problems is they're problems that arise because we're not in a world of zero transaction costs. And you then have to think about what, in various cases, would prevent the transaction that would solve the problem, and then you want to set up legal rules so that as far as possible, where transactions have to be made, they're ones that are makeable, as it were. That's a noticeable chunk of the other course I'm teaching this semester. Miller and Modigliani did something similar. They were looking at a different question. They were looking at the very simple question of a firm deciding how much of its capital to get by equity and how much by debt. All right, a firm can raise capital by selling stock, and the stockholders have a claim to a proportional share of the firm's revenue, basically. or they can raise capital by borrowing it on the debt market. And Miller Modigliani assumed for the purposes of their theoretical analysis that everybody had perfect information. That doesn't mean that there's no uncertainty, but it only means that people know what the gambles are, as it were. They assumed that there was no taxation, and I think there were a couple of other assumptions I've forgotten that went into the model. And with that model, it turned out they could show that it did not matter what mix of debt and equity a firm used, that the total value of the firm would be the same whether it financed it mostly with equity or mostly with debt. I'm not going to explain how they did it, for one thing, because I don't know, because I've never read through the proof of the Miller-Modigliani theory. But it does, assuming they prove it, show that the reason it does matter is because of imperfect information, taxation, or other such things, and that's the first step to analysis of whether this firm ought to have more equity or more debt. So if you think about the theorem, I can try to make it plausible to you. The general view has been for a long time, I'm not sure if it's changed in the last 6 months or not, that equity in the long term always pays better than debt. From the standpoint of the investor, that if you buy a random collection of stocks and hold it for a long time, you will make more money than if you bought a random collection of bonds and held them for a long time. At the moment, stocks are doing very badly. Conceivably, it's not true at the moment. On the other hand, there have been other times when stocks went badly, and it was still the case that even after a drop, assuming you'd held it for a fairly long length of time, you were better off with stocks. But if that's right, it means that from the standpoint of a firm, it looks as though the firm ought to always benefit by getting its financing by debt instead of by equity, because it's getting it cheaper. It's paying a lower interest rate, in effect, on the debt than on the equity. And so you would think, if I was a stockholder, I would always say, let's borrow some more money, use it to buy back some of the stock, and on net, we will then be richer, because instead of paying the other stockholders 8%, we'll be paying our lenders 6%. And one explanation from the lender's standpoint is, yes, equity may pay more in the long term, but its payoff is much more uncertain, and people often are in a situation where what they care about is not what will happen in 20 years, but what will happen in 5 years or in 6 years. So that's why they're willing to accept a somewhat lower return in exchange for the greater certainty of owning bonds instead of owning stocks. And the Miller-Modigliani answer, as I understand it, is if you imagine a firm that is shifting from equity to debt, that means it's becoming more and more highly leveraged. The debt, after all, is an obligation to pay a fixed amount per year, not a fixed fraction of its income. And the more it has to pay per year for its debt, the higher the variance in its profit after paying it. That basically, the remaining stockholders, fewer shares of stock, same value of the firm, but the value of the firm is going to go up a lot if the firm does well, because it's got this fixed payment and then a much bigger income. It's going to go down a lot if the firm does badly, because it's still got the fixed payment. The more risky equity is, the more you've got to give the stockholders to make them willing to hold that equity. So therefore, the argument is that as you become more highly leveraged, while it is true you're trading expensive equity for cheap debt, it's also true that you're making whatever equity you've got left more and more expensive, or putting it differently, less valuable than any given return to the stockholders, because it's becoming riskier and riskier. And if you go further enough, far enough, of course, if you get highly enough leveraged, you start having to pay risk premiums on your debt, because the lenders say, if you're that highly leveraged, you could go bankrupt in a bad year. All right? So apparently, as I haven't read through the proof of the theorem, but they showed that given their simplifying assumptions, these effects exactly cancel in such a way that the total value of the firm is the same with any mix. Let's go on to the next article that our book discusses, and I'm really doing, as you can see, is sort of going through the stuff the book goes through, but from my point of view rather than theirs. And Johnson and Meckling go back to what's really Burrell Means Adam Smith story, but in terms of something that we discussed not long ago, namely agency theory. the when we were talking about contracts, we talked about the question of how do you design a contract to make your agent do what you want him to do. And you can think of the Burrow means problem as simply a problem of agency theory, that the CEO is an agent of the stockholders, but the stockholders have a problem in making him act as his, as their agent. And as they put it, there are really three different costs in general to the agency problem. One is the cost to me of monitoring my agent, of whatever I do to figure out whether he's actually doing what I tell him to do. One is the cost to the agent of persuading me that he's a faithful agent, for example, posting a bond so that if he runs off with my property, I'll get something. And one of them, since we can never do a perfect job of making the agent act in the interest of the principal, is whatever the net loss is as a result of our failure to perfectly discipline. And those are the costs from the agency problem. And we can think about this in the context of a firm and go back to the simple case, the case that Burl and Means see as the way the world used to be run for a couple of hundred years prior to when they're writing, which is that the firm is normally run by the guy who owns it. And of course, lots of firms are still run by guys who own them. I suppose with regard to my writing activities and speaking activities, I'm really a one-man firm. And if you own the whole firm, then it's in your interest to maximize your profit. And you do that. Profit, of course, is not limited to pecuniary profit. Pecuniary profit is your actual money. But if I say to myself, well, somebody will pay me $500 if I spend a week driving up to Alaska and giving a speech for the Federalist Society in Alaska, I say, well, it's true, they'll pay me $500 and the gas will only cost $400, but a week's time driving for $100 is a net loss because I'm interested not merely in money but in my own happiness and so forth. So that the firm that is run by its owner has he has the right incentives to maximize the net gain, counting all of the pecuniary and non-pecuniary returns, which might include what his neighbors think of him, what his employees think of him. It might include the opera, right? He's now spending his own money if he gives it to the opera, and there's no particular reason to do it from the firm, but maybe the firm is in a position to provide the opera, the firm can hire some of the opera singers part-time, and that helps the opera get along or something. I don't know what a good example is, but you can think of ways in which he can do useful things. However, just as with insurance, the more of the ownership is transferred to other people, where ownership means in particular the share of the profits that they get, the less he has the right incentives. So you could imagine a case where suppose that he sells 40% of the equity and holds 60%. There's no problem now with monitoring because he's still the one with complete control over things, and he knows what he's doing. The problem is with incentives because now he says to himself, shall I stay up late working tonight to see if I can find a cheaper supplier for one of our inputs? Well, I'd really like to get a good night's sleep, and besides, my wife will be mad at me, and it's true, if I pull this off, it'll make us $500, but I'm only going to get $300 of that. $300 isn't enough to pay me to get my wife mad at me. $500 would have been, and so when I was 100% ownership, I would have done it. And you could think of all sorts of decisions of that sort. And if you keep going to the point of a standard joint stock company where the CEO probably owns less than 1% of it, you can see that we're back with the problem we were with 10 or 15 minutes ago, namely that the manager no longer has a reasonable incentive to do what the stockholders want. And now, if the other people have a majority interest, they can try to control him as an agent, but that runs the problem with dispersed stockholding, that it requires monitoring by the stockholders. All right. So that's a way of looking at the same problem. Question? No question. So this tells us that there are real advantages to a firm run 100% by its owner. And lots of small firms indeed are run 100% by the owner, or maybe by a family which presumably has the advantage of some altruism that people care about other members of the family, and cheap ways of monitoring because you can watch what the other members of the family are doing. We have some friends who live outside of Chicago where the family industry is wholesale butchers. And I've just found it very interesting watching sort of the difference between their style of having a family and of raising children and ours, both of which work fine. I mean, they've got nice kids. They're happy people. I like them a lot. But to them, to me, the natural thing is that you engage your kids intellectually as you're growing up. My daughter audited classes like this when she was, 14 or 15 or 16, discuss ideas with them and so forth. To them, the natural thing is that when the kids are in high school, they're spending some hours a week doing bookkeeping for the firm or delivering chunks of meat somewhere or sort of integrating into this family project. And will they end up in that firm? It's not clear, but they're a whole lot more likely to end up as entrepreneurs of some sort than my kids are, because that's the world that they're a part of and have been socialized to. I found it sort of very intriguing in terms of different patterns. But neither of which is what I think of as the standard child-rearing pattern, so to speak, in which the schools are supposed to do it all. So where is the problem with a firm run 100% by its owner? The obvious problem is that the firm needs a lot of capital. Well, how can the owner get capital? He's got whatever wealth he's got himself to put into it, which is fine for, small firms, and he can borrow money. But, of course, his ability to borrow money runs into two problems. One problem is he can go bankrupt, which is going to be a real problem, and the other is that if there's a risk of his going bankrupt, people will be unwilling to lend him money except at a high premium. So therefore, although he can put up some of his money, own money, and he can borrow some money, there are going to be limits to that, at which point you then start sliding over to the joint stock model, where you've got other people who have an ownership stake in the firm, get a share of it, at which point his incentives are now diluted. So that's sort of the tension that you're always running under. Second model, which arguably works, if not quite as well, pretty well, much better than dispersed ownership, is the concentrated stock ownership model. And that's one where you've got one or two or three large stockholders, which might be individuals, they might be firms, they might even be CalPERG, although how well CalPERG monitors investments, I don't know. But large stockholders, where large might mean 10% of the firm. If you own 10% of a big firm, it's worth putting quite a lot of effort into making sure that your stock, even though your stake in the firm is a mere $100 million, for $100 million it's worth paying some attention to what the firm is doing, billion-dollar firm, say. And if there are a couple of large stockholders and they're paying attention and they say to themselves, we got a problem with this CEO. Look, there have been three different opportunities that the competitive firms grabbed, and he just ignored because he was too conservative. Let's vote him out. And between us, we can vote him out. All right? So this suggests one reason why firms are sometimes taken private, not necessarily to having a single manager run it, but to having a small group of people with higher leverage, with more debt, but now taking it over and running it in a hopefully better way. So, summarizing the situation, with dispersed ownership, stockholders have little incentive to monitor the managers who are their agents for running their firm, so managers can serve their own objectives for the stockholders' money in various ways that I've discussed. Legal restrictions on such behavior are weak. There is a general rule called the business judgment rule, which basically says the presumption is that the managers get to decide what the firm does, and only in relatively extreme cases can you overcome that presumption. It's possible that that's the right rule, because you could argue that if there are too many ways in which other people can second-guess the managers and force them to do other things, then the advantages of the hierarchical system for coordination break down. There are also market restrictions on the degree to which managers can steal money from stockholders because of the possibility of proxy fights and takeovers. The difference being that in a proxy, in a takeover, I'm actually buying up enough stock to vote out the existing board and thus get rid of the CEO. In a proxy fight, I'm persuading other stockholders to vote with me. Of course, you could combine the two. Large institutional stockholders provide a concentrated ownership, which solves it. What's a junk bond? Does somebody define a junk bond for me?
Something that's
risk, or is it poorly rated by the credit?
It's basically a high risk bond, and the term was used largely for bonds that were associated with takeovers. So that basically you've got a bunch of people, they want to take over a $10 billion company, they only have $1 billion of their own, they borrow $9 billion essentially on the understanding that that's being backed by the company they're going to own. So they're making the company much more highly leveraged. Yeah, I thought it would be an interesting research project, which is sort of in political rhetoric, to see if there are any major countries in the world where their word for junk bond is not a pejorative term. All right, junk bond sounds like it's something dishonest or criminal, though in fact it was just as honest as any other bond. You're paying a higher interest rate in exchange for higher risk. But it's a whole lot easier to demonize somebody like Milken if you say, what was he doing? He was selling junk bonds. Than if you say, what was he doing? He was giving people an opportunity to engage in risky investments at a high return. So the question is, if in Italy, say, and I'm making this up, the term for junk bond was, you know, golden opportunity, was the result that there was a lot less political pressure to prevent takeovers to go after people who made money that way. I have no idea if it's true. I asked some German speaker and he says the term is equally pejorative in German. So that's as far as I've so far determined. But it's be interesting to know sort of how much. One of the things that intrigues me is the general idea, what I think of as the real equivalent of magic in the world, of small causes causing large effects, as it were. And it's sort of, if you want to change the world, it's at least tempting to think about, are there ways in which you could tweak things just a little bit, you know, a mere $1 million investment or something, which would change the world. And my favorite successful example of that is the invention of the pill, of the oral contraceptive. Because my understanding is that it was in fact funded by somebody who thought that the existence of such a thing would have social changes that she approved of. Whether she was right, I don't know, because I don't know what she thought it would do, but it clearly had sizable social effects, and I gather you're only talking again about something in the $1 million to $10 million, which is really chicken feed if you're thinking about changing a world. And so that would be nice to know more of that story, but I came across a bit of it at some point, and that seemed to be what was happening. So if you think about, if you're a journalist and you coin the term junk bond, is that a really cheap way, if you're clever enough, of changing the world? Or you could think of other terms you could coin for the same reason. So in any case, proxy fights and takeovers are another way of disciplining firms. But, of course, since in the takeover, one group of stockholders is getting the firm with much less than 100% ownership, that then raises the issues of conflicts over stockholder control. And there are legal attempts, how successful I don't know, to prevent this by requiring equal treatment of all the stockholders. All right, let me stop for a moment because I'm going to go on to another subject, one which, if any of you have got MBAs, you've probably spent plenty of time on before, but I assume most of you don't, and it's in fact an important issue for law and for your life and for everything else. It's something I remember Consumer Reports getting catastrophically wrong once when they had an article on mortgages, and that's the issue of the time value of money. So before I talk about that, before I abandon the question of why are firms the size they are and how do we discipline managers and all the rest of it, is there any of that stuff you would like to discuss or questions about? Yes.
I was just wondering where, because I don't think you mentioned it, but the possibility of a shareholder derivative suit, would that play into, as far as like a disincentive to mismanage the firm's money?
But it's a restriction on the business judgment rule, and therefore it also plays into making it harder to do right things as well. Yeah, you may know more, you probably do know more about this than I do. What do stockholders have to establish in order to win a derivative suit?
I'm actually not sure.
All right. Because my impression is that over a fairly wide range of discretion, they can't do it. And that somehow it's got to be something which they can convince the court is really a misdeed of a clear sort rather than just a mistake, as it were. But I really don't.
Material misrepresentation.
Aha, uh-huh, material.
Like the best example, I think, is when you have the options backdated. So the financial statements misstated what actually really was. So
right.
You can sue them based on that.
Right. Yeah, well, that's very good. Thank you. That would be an example where they're lying to the stockholders about what they're doing or what's happening, in which case that would certainly do it. All right. So, time value of money, and this is a very general issue relevant to finance and many other things, and that is that you're making decisions in which you're making trade-offs between payments now and payments in the future. And my favorite horrible example was an article a long time ago in Consumer Reports, which is, I think, generally a pretty competent publication, on choosing among different kinds of mortgages. And what did they do? They said for each form of mortgage, what is the total number of dollars you will pay out, assuming you're buying a $100,000 house or whatever it was at the time. What's the total amount you'll pay out over the lifetime of the mortgage? Pick whatever mortgage that number is smallest for. And of course, the answer is that number is smallest buying with cash. Because any mortgage with positive interest rates, you will end up paying more than the principal by the time you're finished, because you'll pay the principal plus the interest. And the longer the mortgage is, the more the number of dollars is going to be. And the implicit mistake they were making was assuming that a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. They were assuming that a dollar paid this year is equivalent to me to a dollar paid 5 years from now or a dollar paid 10 years from now. And that statement is wrong. And it's wrong for two reasons that it's easy to confuse. One of the reasons is inflation, the fact that the dollar 10 years from now may in fact buy much less than the dollar now. And I think there's a significant chance that we're going to get big inflations again in the next 5 years or so. We've been out without them for quite a while now. But the other reason is that even in a world of constant prices, even in a world where there's no inflation at all, there are typically positive interest rates. And there are positive interest rates because money now can be used to produce stuff in the future. So that if I have money now, I can use it to plant a bunch of apple trees, and those apple trees will keep yielding me apples for a long time. If I don't have the money for another 10 years, I can't start getting my apples for another 10 years. And the typical rule of thumb, is that the real interest rate, which is the interest rate after allowing for inflation, is about 2%. That's historically been true for, I think, the last 200 years. Maybe 1% sometime, maybe sometimes 3%, but that's the sort of normal range. That sounds very low, but that's because we take for granted positive, although not enormously high, rates of inflation. So if you imagine, say, a 10% inflation rate, which by modern standards is pretty high, although it's very low compared to some historical examples, if I lend you $100 and in a year you pay me back $110, what interest rate have I really gotten if prices have gone up 10% in the meantime?
Zero,
right? Because the 110 will buy the same stuff as 100 before. So therefore, roughly speaking, the real interest rate is the nominal interest rate, which is the interest rate that's reported in the newspaper, minus the inflation rate. Minus isn't quite right because you're compounding, but that's close enough for most practical purposes. So how do we deal with all of this? And one way that we commonly deal with it is to figure out what is the exchange rate, as it were, between a dollar this year and a dollar next year. It's not the inflation rate. How do I turn money this year into money next year? I mean, one way is to put it under my mattress, but usually that's not the best way. How do I change $10,000 this year into money next year if I don't need it for a year?
Invested.
Yeah, I lend it in some form or other. I invest it, I put it in the bank paying interest, I buy a T-bill, whatever. I lend it out in interest in some form or other. How do I turn $10,000 next year into money this year? No, these are two alternative situations.
I borrow,
right? I borrow against my expectations. If the interest rate is 10%, I borrow a little over $900. At the end of a year, I owe $1,000. Here's my $1,000 that I'm getting at the end of the year. I pay off the debt. So that means that people, in effect, can move money through time at the interest rate. You can change a dollar today to a dollar plus the interest on a dollar a year from now, and you can change a dollar plus the interest on a dollar a year from now to a dollar today.
All right.
Which also means you can change a dollar a year from now to a dollar divided by one plus the interest rate today. Same thing.
Right.
Everybody happy with that way of putting it? Let me take the lottery case, because that's a nice case, because that's a case where governments routinely engage in fraud. And I don't know enough about the law of fraud to know whether a private firm would get in trouble for doing it. but they make statements about how much you'll win if you win the lottery. And they're always lying. Because the lottery payout, I think always, that they're calculating it on, is an annuity, not a fixed payment. So if they tell you, we're going to pay you $500,000 a year for 20 years, how much are they really offering you? $10 million? 20 times 500,000? How would you figure out, in principle, what they're really offering you? What would you have to know? You'd have to know the interest rate, the relevant interest rate, and we'll get to what that means in a minute, because that's a little tricky. And you would then say, all right, the first $500,000 is $500,000. The interest rate is 10%, the next $500,000 is really about $450,000, because if I had $450,000 today, I could lend it out at 10% and get $500,000. The next one is a little over $400,000, and you just have to add up all those sums, and you'd end up with a total that was much less than $10 million. So that's interesting. Does anybody know what, in the non-governmental context, if I say, if you agree to this, I'll pay you $1 million, and what I really mean is I'll pay you $100,000 a year for 10 years. Have I engaged in actionable fraud? Anyone know? I'll let anybody who feels like it research the question. I'm just curious. But my impression is that governments pretty routinely, the way I like to put it is that one of the job responsibilities of the Secretary of the Treasury is to lie, because he's supposed to sell Treasury bonds, and how do you sell, get people to buy government securities? You tell them what a wonderful investment they are. You know, they may not be a bad investment, but they're not consistently a particularly good investment. But like anybody else who's flogging his product, he's got an obligation to try to make it look good. All right, so I'm just running through on the screen what we've just done verbally, and that is that $1,000 equals $1,000 times 1.1 in another year, times another 1.1 in 2 years, and so forth, and you can write it backwards the same way. Or at the interest rate we call R, which is for some odd reason we always do call the interest rate, then $1,000 is $1,000 this year is $1,000 times 1 plus R next year, is $1,000 times 1 plus R times 1 plus R in 2 years, and $1,000 times 1 plus R to the 10th power in 10 years. For small interest rates, you can just add up the numbers. You can say, well, 1% a year for 10 years is about 10%, but you're really multiplying 1.1 times 1.1, which does not give you 1.2. It gives you 1.21 if you multiply it. And if the rate is not 1% but 10%, then the compounding matters quite a lot, because 1.1 raised to the 10th power is quite a lot larger than 2. Work out with your calculators or in your heads by yourself. So if we're comparing present and future things, we do what I've just run through verbally already. You can transfer each dollar today into a dollar times 1 plus the interest rate a year from now, or the same thing in the other direction. And that's quite useful if you're trying to decide between two job offers. You know, one of the job offers pays you a bonus for signing, but then a lower salary, or one of the job offers guarantees you a certain increase over the period of the job. You think of other cases like that, and you want to say which is worth more, discount them to the same date to today, and figure out which comes out to more. Notice, however, that there are at least two buried assumptions in this analysis which simplify the analysis a lot but don't happen to be true. One of them is that your future payments are certain, that probably when the state of Illinois says we'll pay you $500,000 a year for 20 years, that's probably true. On the other hand, the assumption that the inflation rate won't change between now and then is a lot iffier. And if it changes enough, then you aren't really getting what you think you're getting. And it's always possible that a state could go bankrupt. Countries do go bankrupt, you know. And it's a whole lot more possible now than it was a year ago for the U.S., because the U.S. is in the process of roughly doubling its national debt. And at some point, we don't know when, but at some point, lenders may decide it's not such a safe investment after all. And if that's the case, we're in fairly serious trouble. I gather that one of the effects of the period of substantial inflation back, I suppose it would have been about in the 60s and 70s, was that government debt shifted from long-term to short-term. That if you are lending money to a government long-term and you're worried about the inflation rate, you're going to require a fairly high interest rate because you're going to say over the long-term they can inflate a lot of your money. If you're only lending for 6 months, you don't really care what the inflation rate is. But you would in Weimar Germany, where the inflation rate was many 100% a month. But in the context of the U.S., you don't care whether the inflation rate is 1% or 10%. You don't care very much if you're only lending it for 6 months. And you know what the inflation rate is because it's not going to change very much over 6 months. So the U.S. government, in order to be able to borrow at reasonable rates, I gather, had to shift to doing most of its borrowing short-term, which also means that the situation is somewhat more unstable if people decide that it's not such a good risk. So as I say, you have to think, whoever is making the payment, how sure are you that the future payment will be made? And the other assumption that goes into the analysis that makes life much easier but is clearly wrong for most of us is that the interest rate you can borrow at and the interest rate you can lend at are the same. Right? That if you actually want to go borrow money, you will probably find that you have to pay a higher interest rate than the interest rate that you can safely get if you invest your money, if you lend the money. And if you can't do that, then really the present value calculation is giving you sort of an upper and lower bound. It's saying that if it turns out that with everything else you're doing, you end up borrowing money, then the relevant interest rate for comparing present to future is the interest rate you pay on borrowing. On the other hand, if you in fact are going to have lots of money now and need money in the future, so you're going to be lending money out, then the relevant interest rate for your calculation is if you use money now, you're foregoing the interest rate, and therefore the relevant interest rate is the lending interest rate. All right? So that gives you. And then all of this analysis is used to do present value calculations in which you have a stream of payments and you get it back to a single number in one. Questions? No. Right. You've just won the lottery. The prize is $10 million, half a million for 20 years, and they offer you $5 million today as an alternative, as they sometimes will do. And the market interest rate is 10%. Should you accept? Should you take $5 million or should you take $10 million? Which would you rather have? Choice is $500,000 a year for 20 years or a flat $5 million today. And ignore taxes. There might be tax advantages to one or the other, which would complicate the analysis.
Inflation. More inflation
as well. The market interest rate is 10%.
Okay.
So I don't, for this analysis, whether the reason is an inflation rate of 8% and a real interest rate of 2%, or inflation of 0 and a real interest rate of 10%, I don't think matters for this particular choice, though it matters for lots of other things. Can anybody answer the question? But which would you rather have? $500,000 a year for 20 years, or $500,000 a year forever? Is that an easier question? You see why that's the same question? If you believe that 10% interest rate is going to stay, now that's a critical question. But if you believe that not only is the market interest rate 10%, but it's going to stay 10% for the next 20 years, if they give you $5 million, you lend it out at 10% interest, it pays you $500,000 a year, which is exactly the same amount you would have gotten on the other deal, except that at the end of 20 years, you still have $5 million. Instead of zero, which is what you would have on the other deal. So as long as your 10% is a safe number, you are clearly better off. If you think there's going to be inflation, you're even more better off taking the $5 billion, because after all, that means that interest rates will be even higher in the future. Nominal interest rates is what you're lending out at. Or putting it differently, that means that your alternative is an even worse deal, because by the time the 20 years is over, you can use that last $500,000 for taxi fare. Somewhere there's some science fiction short story where a guy arranges to be frozen or something, and he puts his assets, you know, he's worked it out, the glories of compound interest, and he's put his assets in some safe form, and sure enough, when he wakes up 200 years later, he's got $50 million, and he calls up his broker or somebody to arrange things, and at the end of the call, he's saying, partway through the call, a voice breaks into the call and says, "Very, thank you. That'll be $50,000 for the next 5 minutes." And he realizes that he isn't quite as well off as he thought he was. So in any case, calculation you could make, the harder version, is how low does the interest rate have to be for you to prefer the $500,000 a year for 20 years? And the way you would do that is you would take $500,000 a year for 20 years, you would discount it back to the present at various interest rates, and you would see what's the interest rate at which it's exactly $5 billion. So the two are exactly equivalent. And if you don't feel like doing the arithmetic, I bet Excel has got a program that will do that for you. And if you're lazy, the easy way of doing that one, can somebody, suppose the interest rate is 5%, what is the present value of a dollar a year forever? This is a question that can be answered in 5 seconds. It does not require elaborate mathematics. Let me turn it around. At 5%, how much money must you lend out in order to get a dollar a year forever? What? $20, right? If you have $20 at 5%, every year they pay you a dollar. Forever. So therefore, the present, again, we're assuming a fixed interest rate forever, and the present value of a dollar a year forever is exactly 1 over the interest rate. Because if the interest rate is 10%, $10 would give you a dollar a year forever. If the interest rate is 1%, $100 would give you a dollar a year forever. So therefore, the present value of a dollar a year forever is 1 over the interest rate. And that gives you the quick way, if you don't have Excel, of answering my harder version, which is that $500,000 a year forever is equal to that amount divided by the interest rate at the moment. $500,000 a year starting in the 21st year is equal to that amount divided by the interest rate in the 21st year. $500,000 for 20 years is equal to $500,000 forever minus $500,000 starting on the 21st year forever. So all you actually have to do is to subtract, and you can answer this very complicated question: what is the present value of $500,000 a year for 20 years at any given interest rate? You just say the value forever is the amount divided by the interest rate. The value forever starting 21 years is the amount divided by the interest rate, but in 21-year dollars, not in current dollars. Discount that back by 1 plus r to the 20th, and we're back home free. Don't worry if that isn't obvious, but for at least those of you who are used to playing with numbers, it should be obvious, and it gives a really quick way of doing certain kinds of problems. And in fact, there, I think, still is a security called the British Console, which paid, I think, £1 a year forever, and therefore had a market value of 1 over whatever people thought the interest rate was going to be. Can do the same calculation backwards. You can say, here is an investment. The investment costs a certain amount today. It gives you a stream of money. What is the internal rate of return? The internal rate of return means making this investment is equivalent to lending out that money at what interest rate? You can say, all right, we're going to build a $1 million factory. It'll make us $200,000 a year for 8 years and then collapse. Well, what is the interest rate at which $200,000 a year for 8 years is equivalent to $1 million today? That's the interest rate that we're implicitly earning on our investment when we build that factory. And the firm can then say, if the cost to us of capital is less than that, then we are in effect borrowing at 4% and lending at 6% when we build that factory. That's a good deal. On the other hand, borrowing at 6% and lending at 4% is not such a good deal, and therefore that's how we can figure out what to do. So all of this is ways in which you can think about the firm's decision. Or your decision, of course, because if you're getting a house with a mortgage, you're making analogous decisions of your own. Or if you're accepting a job offer where you are pretty sure that your low pay in the first years will be balanced by high pay in later years. Now, this is risky, by the way. Adam Smith had one example of consistent irrationality that he mentioned. He says that in any field where returns are very uncertain, I think lawyers was actually one of his examples, as I remember, back in the 18th century, the average salary is low. And why is the average salary low? Because people decide what firm to go into when they are young adults. And young adults are irrationally optimistic about their own lives. And therefore, if you know that becoming a lawyer is a lottery with a 80% chance of, you know, making $50,000 a year, but a 2% chance of making $1 million a year, you're sure you're in the 2%. And therefore, people keep going into the field until they've driven it down so the average return is lower than in being something like a carpenter that's less exciting. But anyway, I don't know if he's right or not, but it was a neat argument. All right, well, I will be putting up my PowerPoints at some point. And as I say, the exam with answers is up on the board. And you can all look at it. And Thursday, we will continue doing this stuff. And my battery didn't even run out. Almost, but not quite.